Okay, so I am here with David Haidu, who is most recently the author of The 10-Cent Plague. David, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
That's good.
That's great. Well, that's good for both of us here.
Two good people talking comics.
Exactly. We're talking comics. Well, I actually wanted to first of all ask you, starting with how you conducted the interviews for this book. Many of the chapters are taken from primary sources, mm-hmm. 150 interviews that you conducted mm-hmm. over 7 years, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if there were certain advantages and disadvantages to this approach as opposed to mining through newspapers and the like, because, I mean, mm-hmm. some of these interesting figures aren't exactly alive. Mm-hmm. So how did you go about prioritizing various things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm trained as a journalist, so I like to tell untold stories. My way of thinking, if a story is already told, what's the point in telling it again? I like to do recent history because then I could find the witnesses of the events and take my time with them and do probing interviews and try to not just reconstruct the events, but get through to the thinking and the feelings of the people who were involved. So I've done that with all three of my books. Yeah. Now, in this case, I was really lucky because there were still over 100 people, over 150 people who were involved in this comic scare of the 40s and 50s who were still around. The hardest thing was really finding them.
Yeah.
But the advantage to talking to them, there are several. One is I wanted to talk to people who others didn't talk to before. And there's several categories in them. This is well worth us talking over. One are kids, or the people who were kids at the time. They're now grown and well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes, they're no older than that among the people who were young people in the 30s, 40s, and mostly in the 40s and 50s. Because if you look behind us, there's a file cabinet there that has my research materials, and there are two drawers of clippings of articles about comics in this period, hundreds of articles about the comics hysteria of this period. But hardly anyone ever asked the readers of the comics what they thought at the time. In the 40s and 50s, nobody talk to the kids, because in those days, and this is one of the key themes of the book and one of the key issues here, was that in those days, kids weren't considered qualified to have worthwhile opinions or worthwhile tastes. So kids were a big point. And another, I also wanted to talk to artists who left comics, many of whom were driven out of the comics field in the 50s. And many of them had never been interviewed before, so I couldn't Google them or even use conventional indexes to see, read their past interviews in newspapers or magazines or even comics journals, because many of them disappeared in the early 1950s and never been interviewed. People like Mort Lev, L-E-A-V, for instance. He loved comics. Beautiful, I mean, gorgeous and important work, was driven out of the field and was never interviewed. Janice Vallou, who's figures in the prologue of the book, had never been interviewed. Martin Thall, a number of other comics artists who had just disappeared. So I needed to talk to them. And I could go on and on just about this one subject, but that's just one. I wanted to talk to people who hadn't been talked to before. For the value of their testimony, and I had to do it myself.
Yeah. Did you have to hire a private investigator, or was it a matter of doing the 6 degrees of separation game for this?
I've done that in the past. No, I didn't do that. I did do that once for my first book. I was desperate to find somebody, and I tried all conventional methods. And I used very grassroots methods to identify the names of the comics artists. I went to the original comics, and I went to collectors of the comics and the holdings of vintage comics at various institutions, including some universities, the Ohio State University and University in Buffalo. And I went through the personal collections of some collectors, went to the original comics, and then looked for the names of the artists. I mean, really grassroots, held the comics in my hand, looked for the signatures And then also use the Grand Comic Database, which is a sensational resource and has a lot of credits in it. But the Grand Comic Database wasn't as extensive when I started my research as it is now. So then I made a list of names of people, and I targeted the people who I wanted to talk to most. And then I used a combination of common sense and this legwork. Went through white pages of phone books in the areas where I knew the people lived, or I suspected the people lived, or where I thought they might have moved to retire. So I spent a lot of time going through the Florida phone book. That's how I found Janice Vallou.
Wow.
I figured, well, people who were of a certain age in the 30s and 40s had a mindset to that probably retiring and probably went to Florida. Yeah. And that's how I found a lot of people.
I'm wondering if certain artists may have changed their names because the comic book industry was considered a great calumny for many of these various artists and writers. Did you face a problem along those lines in tracking people down?
I did. I had trouble with people who changed their names, but not for that reason. Because most people use their real names, and most people, not all, some use pseudonyms, still do in comics, but most people tended to use their real names. But women married.
Yeah.
And women who married in that time took on their husbands' names. And I was surprised to find when I was doing my research how many women there were in comics. I mean, dozens and dozens of women and who did terrific, I mean, and important work in comics. Marcia Snyder is one. I was never able to find her. I'd been told that she married, and no one I could find knew what her married name was. A great many of the... In the case of the great many of the women artists, I only had their maiden names, and I couldn't find them. I tried Social Security records, but they weren't of that much value. And I did hit a wall with women artists. I'm sure that to this day, much of their story remains untold.
Wow.
Because they've been impossible to find.
Well, what steps did you take to atone for this? Because if you're slicing off a portion of comic book history, a very important part of comic book history that involved women. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you make up for this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I sought to do justice to the story that I can tell. I don't know what I don't know. I did make a point to ask about those women to the people who I could find. And that's the only recourse. But as long as I targeted that as an objective, and I made sure, here's an example. Toni Bloom is gone. She's deceased now, but I did find that she married a fellow named Bill Bossert. Bill Bossert worked for the Eisner and Iger shop, but then he seemed to disappear. And he never worked in comics after the Purge in the early 20s. But I finally tracked him down to Germany, where he had remarried and had settled as he was teaching fine art in Germany. So he was able to tell me about his wife, and I was able to reconstruct a pretty good idea of who she was and what was she was about from the testimony of her husband. So, that's the only recourse of a historian or a journalist if a subject or a witness of events is not available, you ask everybody else around. You do a write around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you alluded earlier to wanting to track down the kids who grew up with these comics. Mm-hmm. I was astonished when I read this book to learn that Irvin Kershner had this early career as essentially a government propagandist, and yet, if you examine the trajectory of his career, he would go on to direct RoboCop 2, which was, of course, written by Frank Miller. Mm-hmm. And yet, you didn't, or at least as far as I know, didn't track him down. I mean, what steps did you take to go after the people who were legislating this comics code, or the people who were the moralists? I mean, I know you had David Mace.
There's no one, there's not a name that I could find that I didn't attempt to track down. Kershner was gone. Kershner was dead, was deceased. So he wasn't available. But there was not a name that I didn't try to find. In fact, I did find, Kershner did worked, made the trumped up pseudo documentary footage that was a centerpiece of a TV series, as you know, because you read the book called Confidential File. It was a rant against comics. The host of it, Paul Coates, was also gone, but I did find the writer of the episode, A.J. Fennedy. He wrote this episode in 1955. And by the time I was doing my research, it was 50 years later. Yeah. But I did find him and interview him.
But in terms
Kirsten
of
was gone.
Yeah. But in terms of memories, I mean, you're dealing with primary sources, and memory may not necessarily be reliable. I mean, did you have to return to the well one too many times in order to get the accuracy? I mean, how did you corroborate facts with various sources?
That is a great question. Because I was interviewing people about events that took place 50 years ago, and I had to confront the vagaries of memory and the fact that time plays a role in the construction of memory. And memory is not a static thing. Memory is a thing is it shifts, and our experiences and the new knowledge that we gain over time color our memories. There's no question about that. So because there's a whole school of how do you do the most rigorous and the most serious, the most reliable oral history possible. There are tools you use. One is you go at the same points, the same questions, at different times, from different ways, you know, and keep a record and try to and corroborate the evidence that you get. And another is I would bring materials. So I would bring, boy, I've had some experiences over the years. For instance, can I give you an example from another book?
Sure.
For my second book, I interviewed Carolyn Hester, who was a folk singer and married, first wife of one of the subjects of my book, Richard Farina. So I researched Carolyn very thoroughly and brought materials with me when I did the first interview. We did a series of interviews. And I asked her, well, Carolyn, Richard, your husband, was not trained as a musician, but you were. You had formal training. You know, you were gifted with a strong, powerful instrument. He was not. What was it like to perform with him? And she said, oh, I never performed with Richard. Oh, well, look at this picture I have here. the two of you on stage. It looks a lot like you're both singing at the same time. Oh, well, gee, when was that? Well, that's the Edinburgh Folk Festival and such and such. Here's some articles about it. In fact, here's a description of the performance. Oh, well, you know what? Now that you think about it, and it starts to come back to her. And she said to me, my God, he had a mustache. I didn't remember that he had a mustache. Now, here we're talking about her own husband not remembering that he had a mustache. So you really have to, really have to make sure to do checks and double checks on memory because it is not fully reliable. On the other hand, it is essential because when you're telling you're telling history that is not fully documented, the record is unreliable. The secondary sources are unreliable. If nobody interviewed the kids, there's just not adequate evidence about what the kids felt. So I would have to say Paul Plaszynski, who was involved in the ritual burning of comics in Binghamton, New York in 1948, I'd have to say over and over, I'd say, Mr. Plaszynski, make sure, is that the way you felt at the time? I mean, really want you to go back and do the best you can to try to remember what it was like. And you can break down borders. Without trying to do that and recognizing that some people are carrying with them stories that deserve to be told, important parts of history would be lost. And the best example, not the best, but a vivid example that I know firsthand, it's not just this book, but my first book, which was the biography of Billy Strayhorn, and which is a very dramatic example of this because very little had been written about Strayhorn prior to the book, and most of what was on the record was inaccurate by design, that Strayhorn and Ellington and the people in their circle had given misinformation to discourage attention, to to keep people away from the story of Strayhorn is because they thought that they were protecting him in that way because he was black and gay and open out of the closet at the time. So, you know, he would say, this is a very relevant here. He would say, I didn't do the very few interviews he did. And he did do a few interviews. Nobody would ask him what he had done on his own because they wouldn't think he had done anything on his own. So he wouldn't bring up the fact that he had a significant career before he ever met Duke. So he wouldn't talk about it. And there were, he had a career outside of his work for Ellington, but he wouldn't talk about it, so nobody asked about it. So Strayhorn had this whole career writing for a group called the Copacetics, and he wrote hundreds of songs for them, but there are no articles in the mainstream press about that work. So the documentary evidence, the secondary materials are unreliable. So I'd have to find the witnesses, talk to the witnesses, and interview them. And the same was true here.
What do you do, though, when you have a really intriguing nugget that... Well, there's two questions I actually have. You have a nugget, and you can't confirm it with another source. Or you have a situation, which you just pointed out, in which the secondary sources, the reports of a particular event or the like, carry on some misinformation that people then remember based off of what is printed down in the newspapers or in some community newsletter or the like. I mean, mm-hmm. How do you sift through that? How do you know that anything that you report is entirely reliable? I mean, you know, there's got to be some percentage of the book in which there's ambiguity along those lines.
Well, I'm asking people not, if it's hard information, I could, if somebody's telling me hard information, I could research it. And I don't use no reliable journal. You know, I teach journalism here, and we make a point at Columbia, and we make a point to teach our students that one of the bedrock principles of journalism is that you don't rely on witnesses for hard factual information. They could provide factual information, but you must corroborate it with others and check with the records. So I wouldn't ask Paul Plaszynski, who was at the Binghamton burning, for instance, tell me about the history of the building, tell me about the school. What did it look like? How many floors were to the school? How many entrances were there? Who designed it? How many students went? For that kind of hard factual information, there are more reliable sources. I could go to historical archives and find that information. But for how did it feel to be a kid who reading comics then? What did you like about them? What did your parents say to you about them? How did it feel to be burning these things that you like? There's no more reliable source than him. As long as in the course of the interviews, you can check and double check and go with the same material from various points of view.
This is an intriguing dilemma that I think all journalists face. I mean, for example, William Gaines, who we can talk about. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a fascinating figure in this book. At first, he's sitting there and he does testify in front of the Senate. Mm-hmm. Then months later, he decides to go ahead and kill the horror comics on the EC line. And then there's the scenario with Charles Murphy, which is a phone call, and in the last panel of one of the stories is an African-American, and that is asked to be removed, and in fact, he basically tells him to essentially fuck off. Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to ask you about this because I was intrigued by the fact that he took Mad Magazine, you know, he took it from comic to magazine form, and he was able to resuscitate it. But I was very curious as to why he didn't do that with the EC horror line. I mean, he mm-hmm. could have just as easily zipped past the comics code by doing the same thing. Were mm-hmm. you able to uncover anything along those lines, or did you simply not have enough information or reliable accounts in your disposal to create that reliable impression for people mm-hmm. to pick up?
Well, those aren't the only options. I ask people in his circle about that. So I asked his business manager, Lyle Stewart. I asked the editor of most of the EC comics, Al Feldstein. I also interviewed a whole string of others who were artists and writers at EC at the time. Quite a few. Jack Kamen, Al Williamson, Marie Severin, who was a colorist. Even the secretary, Shirley Norris, who was the receptionist and the secretary at the time. So I was privy to the testimony to people who were there and knew Gaines, why did he? I heard over and over that he canceled the horror comics for the reason that he said the horror and crime and suspense comics and even the science fiction comics, the whole EC line apart from Mad, because he felt so bloodied, and also he felt that he had no choice. He tried to save them. By revamping the comics and having this clean line of comics about psychotherapy and the newspaper business, and they came back returned, and the shipments came back unopened because they came from EC. So he felt bloodied. He felt that he was losing money. He had no choice. This is this is the way he described those set of events, and it's the way that other people describe them too. Why didn't he reformat those comics in magazine style? I think that they still would have been the same target. So that's about the best answer I can give. And I don't think it didn't seem to occur to him. In fact, it clearly didn't.
that's the big question. Yeah. Because I love all those EC comics. And I mean, there was actually a bunch of bound volumes that were recently reissued the last couple of years. Yeah. And I've been enjoying them immensely. It could have survived just as adeptly, I think, as Mad if it had been refigured or, I mean, because Playboy magazine was on the way. So a shift was definitely in the air.
Well, he did try. He did try that with the line of Picto Fiction, which were magazine format comics. Magazine format publications that returned to the seriousness of the EC line and had some of the cutting edge quality, the venturesomeness, and the bite of the EC line, but in a format that he thought was palatable. He did try exactly this thing. And there were four titles of Picto Fiction magazines, which were text and images, but not in comics format, that he tried to put over, and they just didn't click. Now, what seems obvious to us then, there's a real danger in seeing the past through the lens of the present. And, we see EC now, and we say, my God, this stuff is glorious. And the Kurtzman war comics are so sophisticated, and they're so elegant, and the suspense comics are so ambitious, and that art by Williamson and even Kamen, and it's spectacular. And even some of the writing, Jack Olick was a wonderful writer, and some of Feldstein's stories really had had charm. But in those days, they had just been beaten down and beaten down and beaten down, and very few people were defending their work. You know, there were very few comics advocates. I mean, Gaines volunteered to testify, went out there alone, and he was the lone man standing. And there weren't a lot of, like now, there are volumes and volumes and volumes of criticism, not only of EC, but of comic books. How comics are taken so seriously now that behind you, as we're sitting in my office here at the university, there are six shelves of writing about comics. But in those days, there were no defenders of comics like that. And I remember Will Eisner telling me that it tore him apart that he didn't get wasn't taken seriously at that time. I mean, he was eventually taken seriously, late in life, and he found that very rewarding. But it just tore him apart then.
I'm wondering if you think that if there were more Will Eisners or even Winsor McKays to really push the limits of the literary nature of comics, that this may have led to greater credibility or less pursuits. And then I have another angle in relation to this question about how much of these efforts you sort of impute that the Catholic Church's efforts, which were just before around World War II, they were covered by arts journalism. But it wasn't until the immense efforts later, when you get the Senate involved, when they became hard news stories, and which in turn led to all these civic protests, going to the police, comics create deaths and things like that, where the word comics is now thrown into a headline as an excuse, which is not unlike Columbine in video mm-hmm. games, but right. that's a lot of things to throw at you. But I wanted mm-hmm. to sort of ask, mm-hmm. why do you think was the real linchpin of this? Was it the media? Was it not enough Will Eisners or what?
There's a couple of very good questions here. The first question of, would it have helped if the comics were more literate? Well, that's an imponderable, there's no knowing. And that's too easy an answer. Some of the comics were literate. Some of the comics were very well written and still were not taken seriously. Had they been better written, would they have been taken more seriously? I mean, I could only speculate. And my speculation is that probably not, because they were still perceived of as picture stories. You know, the eye, the way that the brain is wired, the eye gravitates to imagery before language, and it takes in and processes imagery first. And when there's imagery and language, when we have input from in both visual input and rhetorical or input or language at the same time, the visual input dominates. It just does. That's why ham actors on a stage, while who want to steal a scene from someone giving a soliloquy, will, instead of standing still, just do a little bit of visual business. You know, while somebody else is giving a great, no matter how great the acting, as soon as somebody does a little something with their hands, you know, or pulling their earlobe, or you know, or pulling their chin, that's what everybody sees, and that dominates. So In the graphic medium, in the comics medium, the visual dominates. It dominates our perception. It dominates the way comics were taken. The second part of that question, what was the linchpin here? The evidence shows that comics were object of scorn and came under attack for a whole string of reasons that were partly connected, and in some cases unconnected. I mean, at first, they're considered bad for the eyes, or they're considered sacrilegious, or they're thought to induce illiteracy. Then they're considered blasphemous because Superman is endowed with superhuman powers. Then they're fascist. Then they're communist. Then they cause juvenile delinquency. So what's really going on is that people who don't like comics for one reason or another are reverse engineering and trumping up reasons to justify the conclusions that they already had, which are comics are no good. And they're always finding new reasons to justify why they think the comics are no good. And I think at the heart of this is the fact that they think comics are no good because they're not theirs. They don't speak to them. They're not. They're of another world, another culture, and that other world and that other culture belongs to younger people, and so I think that older people find that threatening. They don't understand it. They don't get it. They think it's dangerous in part because it's something young people like, and it represents how different young people can be from who older people are, and that is a deep threat. That is a fear that runs very, very deep. I mean, I'm a parent. I mean, I'm a parent of three, too, and I have three kids, and I know that the fear that your kids will turn on you like a Doberman and will have embrace a different set of values that challenge you, and not just challenge you, but maybe show that you're wrong, or outdated, obsolete, is a very deep fear.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you bring up Frederick Wortham's book, Seduction of the Innocent, and you point out that despite the fact that this was essentially a volume of junk science, it was taken relatively seriously by the New Republic, the New York Times Book Review, the New Yorker. And this despite the fact that the, quote, scientific findings were published in Ladies' Home Journal rather than the American Journal of Psychiatry. Mm-hmm. So this leads me to believe that media was very much a part of this war on comics. That C. Wright Mills, for goodness sakes, mm-hmm. actually gave credence to this book. And so what I'm wondering is I mean, I don't know if the role of the media can really be understated here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's no question about it. It's not just the fact that parents were dubious of comics. They didn't know enough to be dubious about comics until the newspapers and magazines told them to be. You know, until they saw headlines, "A Depravity for a Dime," above the logo of the Hartford Courant. Or they started, or Puddles of Blood in Time magazine. I mean, I had, and again, right behind us is a file cabinet full of clips. And these horrific headlines not just reinforced a point of view that parents had, the establishment had, but taught it, but instilled it. There's no question about that. Yeah. I don't know what else to add, but there's...
I mean, I'm wondering, though, I mean, why, did you uncover any reasons why these major periodicals, which people look to for intellectual mm-hmm. nourishment, uh-huh. were championing a book like The Wortham Book?
Yeah. Well, they didn't all. Yeah. The Times Book Review, yes, but I think to the credit of the Book Review, it's always been a vehicle... for writers. It's always been a writer's vehicle, not an editor's vehicle. And the Times Book Review grants its writers a lot of license and doesn't try to skewer the results or front-load the results. So C. Wright Mills liked this book. If he didn't like the book, I'm sure it would have gotten panned. The Times, the New Republic was very critical of I'm not just defending this because I'm a columnist. It's not just because the New Republic does have a tradition of being contrarian, and I think looking deeper at subjects. I think, but that's my home. I'm a columnist for the New Republic, but they were kind of alone and looking with scrutiny at this book, The Seduction of the Innocents, and really taking Wortham to task for his shaky science. But why did others buy into this? It was a potent story that answered a lot of questions. It provided easy answers to questions that were vexing people. Young people were changing. The culture was changing. Nobody knew why. Here's an easy answer. Let's blame comics. And it seemed credible because here's this guy with a lab coat, on the flap, and who had done other serious work and was a well-meaning person in other ways. And there were no advocates for comics and few people challenging him. So, the argument just kind of cleared without scrutiny in the public domain.
I'm wondering, though, if this is partially an endemic aspect of American culture. As I had sort of suggested earlier, they pinned Columbine on video games. It's almost as if America needs a linchpin every mm-hmm. time to be found within the lower mm-hmm. depths of culture, mm-hmm. as opposed to looking inwards at the details of the situation, perhaps the parents, perhaps actually asking the kids themselves. Mm-hmm. Why is it, do you think, that culture in some form... generally a culture that is considered quite low. Mm-hmm. Why is this the sort of the little kid to pick on
mm-hmm.
here?
Mm-hmm. Well, disreputable arenas of culture have fallen under attack many times and for many reasons. In some cases, justifiably. I mean, some of the questions that are raised about some work that panders to extremes does deserve scrutiny. But other factors that are not so legitimate that come into play are often the fact that it's stuff that appeals to kids, that's new and older people just haven't come to terms with yet, or it's stuff that appeals to that isn't conventionally literate, that's not word-based, therefore is misperceived as being subliterate, and a kind of class bias comes into play then. Also, work that's embraced first by outsider groups you know, not just young people, but African Americans or Latinos. You know, blues is a perfect example, rhythm and blues, and hip hop is another good example. Among in youth culture, rock and roll is another example. You know, young people like it. You know, people of color like it. It must be subversive. It must be stupid. It must, you know, it must be substandard. So a lot of biases come into play. In age biases, racial biases, class biases. You know, they're all factors.
Well, taboo biases as well. I mean, you can plunge further and make a case hypothetically for pornography and porn in general. I mean, what is the solution to this? I mean, it sort of seems to me that sometimes a quote subliterary form. Almost brings it upon themselves because it embraces something that's populist, something that everybody wants to read.
Well, not just because it's populist, because by its nature, it seeks to challenge the status quo. That's a unique selling proposition of the work. That's its function. That was part of the function of comics, was to challenge the status quo. The status quo feels challenged, it then reacts. Well, of course it's going to react. That means that comics are succeeding at their function, just like rock. That was a function of rock and roll. It succeeded. It's the function of video games to a large degree, too. You know, I was about to say something. Oh, porn. You know, I'm thinking maybe of writing a book about porn. You know, what do you think?
It would certainly sell, you know.
Well, you know, my agent says said it wouldn't. And I was thinking of doing a book about the Mies Commission and the explosion of porn in the 80s. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah.
But both my wife, actually my wife probably said this more than my agent, said, well, who's going to buy that and carry it home? He said, it's not a book you could ask for Father's Day or ask for your birthday. It's not a book that you want to be seen reading in the subway or carrying around. I think it's a shame because
I don't know. Mary Roach has Boink coming out.
Yeah, I know.
Think the limits are starting to expand here.
All right, I'm going to do it. You have 10%. The thing that will probably dissuade me from doing that really is like the icky factor. Just, you know, having to, because I spend years and do hundreds of interviews, and to just, you know, spend 5 years talking to the John Leslie's in the world, you know, already I'm, you know, I feel like wiping my hands.
Well, certainly it's a squeamish situation, but then maybe 20 or 30 years from now, it won't be so squeamish. Well, I mean, there'll be something that's even worse. I'm not signing myself up.
It's a perfect topic for you.
I wanted to ask you about the Comics Code, which we've only just alluded to. You pointed out in this book that it was more restrictive than the FCC guidelines, than the Hays Motion Picture Production Code. But I'm wondering why you think there was more of a hue and cry against comics than there was, say, radio, films, and television. Because I should point out that it was 1930 when the Hays Production Code came into being, and 1934 when the Communications Act was passed, establishing the FCC. So, and the efforts on the Comic Code came 2 decades later. So I'm wondering if you think there was something about that post-war atmosphere, or was it more this general assault on comics that had been building across the course of a couple of decades?
It was the last. It was an assault that took several decades to reach critical mass. The comics industry, prior to the enactment of the Comics Code, had another self-regulating, an earlier self-regulating body and an earlier code. But when the earlier comics controversy, because there wasn't just one comics controversy. There were a whole series of them, and they built over time, and they were connected to other events going on in the culture at the time. But these issues came to a head in the early 50s, when they did, the comics industry set out to save itself when it really seemed on the brink of destruction, and it enacted a code that that did exactly the opposite. They essentially, you know, made their own noose and committed hari kari with the code that was excessively restrictive, not only in its details, but in broad strokes, in key restrictions, a couple central key restrictions, such as that comics should not challenge authority.
Yeah,
I mean, it was the language of the code. I mean, actually, challenge wasn't the exact language, but authority. That idea was specific in the code, and so was the idea that comics needed to celebrate. I forget the verb actually. The sanctity of home and marriage.
Yeah,
I'd have to get the code out. We could do that. We could pause this and get the code out. But it's these ideas that comics could not challenge authority and had to reinforce like the suburban ideal that really gelded comics, and you know, and it hurt the comics artists and writers who I talked to, like that's what frustrated them most.
I wanted to ask you about Crime Does Not Pay.
Mm-hmm.
This supposedly depicted true crime, and as you put it, the comic constructed towers of fiction upon a few stones of fact. And yet, isn't this more or less what yellow journalism mm-hmm. did a mm-hmm. few decades earlier?
Mm-hmm.
Was it the pictorial form really that caused this to happen? I mean, I'm wondering mm-hmm. if you think that comics were at risk because it was a medium for storytelling as opposed to an ostensible medium for fact, as the yellow journalism purportedly
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm. It's a great point. That's absolutely the case. Because it was narrative, it had more potency, and therefore came off as more threatening because it was more gripping, it had more power. Another key factor is to not distinguish the comics between the Yellow Kid, but yes, against journalism, and even television and radio and even film, it was visual and drawings, not photographs, and color. And the fact that the comics were drawings and not photographs somehow seemed to make them more threatening. I think because they really clearly represented a point of view. They were clearly interpretive, that they were a take on the world. They didn't just represent the world as it is, but they represented a point of view on the world, a take. They were interpretive. And that has more power. That seems more threatening. And just the fact that they were color. Films were not yet, well, some films were color. Most films were not yet color. I'm Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz were color. Most films were not yet color. Suspense, horror, crime films were certainly not color. So there was nowhere where anyone can see red. This may seem really mundane to us now, but believe me, it was not then. Red blood. I mean, even Hitchcock, when he was making Psycho, chose to make Psycho in black and white because he used chocolate syrup for the blood, you know, to keep it from being too realistic. Even a decade after this, and there was nowhere where young people can see, or anybody can see, kind of red, you know, visual images in this of extreme acts in color. So they had, for several reasons, comics had a special potency.
Charles Biro, of course, being a paramount figure towards perpetuating this notion, and he's going ahead and putting all this on the covers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Charles Biro, what a character! You couldn't invent Charles Biro. You know, my book ends in the mid-50s, so I don't go into what happened to Bob Wood. But you no doubt know that Bob Wood murdered. There's a footnote about it in my book, so it's actually covered in the book. But in a footnote, Bob Wood bludgeoned a woman to death in a hotel with an iron.
Yeah.
You know, horrible thing. And this is a digression and doesn't really have any much bearing on what we're talking about. But he and Biro, forgive me, it's Hungarian. You think I'd pronounce it correctly? Probably deserve a book of their own. Maybe it would be a good subject. There's another one for you. After you do the porn book, you could do Beer on Wood.
Yeah, you're giving me a number of titles to write. But. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
All right.
Great.
Thanks.